Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which believes great beer can be as exciting as great music. Since 1988, Goose Island has been committed to that belief by brewing new styles of beer like 312 Urban Wheat Ale, Sophie Farmhouse Ale, and Bourbon County Stout. Goose Island, to what's next? GooseIsland.com.
This is Sound Opinions, and Greg, you and I get stopped all the time. We're buying coffee, we're shopping at the grocery store, we're at a bar at night. People want to know, what are we listening to? What music should I be hearing? And of course, we're always happy to proselytize, but it's really nice to play the rock doctor on occasion as we do and get to know the patient, really go deep. You know, what do you like? What can we recommend based on your likes, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. A two-week process, you really get to know one of our listeners on that kind of level. That's going to be later on in the show, Jim, but first we've got some music news. That is the Grateful Dead with Shakedown Street. Words that apply, according to some Deadheads, the ardent Grateful Dead fans, to the recent sale of the Grateful Dead's July 3 through 5 concerts at Soldier Field in Chicago, a celebration of the band's 50th anniversary. The concert promoter, Peter Shapiro, is calling this one of the greatest, if not the greatest, single band concert events in rock history. Ticketmaster is reporting that over 500,000 people lined up for the online sale. More than 60,000 people flooded the Grateful Dead office with envelopes requesting tickets. All told, we're talking about 1 million ticket requests for those three shows. They sold about 200,000 tickets, and they are completely sold out. Now, on the secondary market, tickets are showing up for prices of thousands of dollars, some for over $100,000. Grateful Dead fans are basically desperate for these tickets, but Shapiro, the promoter, has some good news for them. He's saying that they are currently exploring efforts or ways to broadcast the show, stream it somehow, get it on people's cell phones and on their laptops if they cannot make those shows in July.
Anyone who's ever been to a sporting event knows that riff. It's Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll. Greg, we have two stories updating court cases from the rock world. Gary Glitter has been sentenced at the age of 70 to 16 years in jail for a really sickening list of child sex crimes. All of those incidents date back to the 70s, but these clouds have been hanging over Glitter's head since the 90s. He was first convicted in 99. He moved to Cambodia. He was deported from that country, returned to Britain. He was also convicted in Vietnam in a court there. Glitter is going away for the rest of his life at the age of 70.
Everybody get up.
Another court case, Jim, not nearly as dire as the Gary Glitter case, but this is a window into the world of copyright infringement in the music industry. I mean, these lawsuits get filed every week, it seems, and there's a good reason why many of them never end up in trial, because it's so embarrassing for a lot of the people involved. That is the case with this Blurred Lines lawsuit. We've been covering this, that big Robin Thicke hit from 2013. The Marvin Gaye family sued, saying that the Blurred Lines song used distinct musical elements of Gaye's 1977 hit, Got to Give It Up. And actually, Thicke initially was pretty forthcoming about that, even filed a preemptive suit trying to prevent the Gaye family from suing him because he recognized the similarities. Well, now the case has come to court in Los Angeles, and the testimony from that is just priceless. We have Thicke basically saying he was on drugs while the song was being composed, and quote, "The biggest hit of my career was written by somebody else, and I was jealous and wanted credit." Thicke got credit, a co-writing credit, for Blurred Lines. He said, "I felt it was a little white lie that didn't hurt his career, but boosted mine." He was referring to Pharrell Williams, whom he admitted basically wrote the song. They asked Pharrell after the hearing that day how he felt about Thicke's testimony, and his words were, "This is what happens every day in our industry."
I think that could be a one-act play.
Yes.
"Please release me, let me go. For I don't love you anymore."
Greg, for our entire careers as critics, we have always kept Tuesday sacred. That's the day new albums were going to drop. We were going to have to write about them. As long as I can remember, new records have arrived in the stores on Tuesday, first on vinyl, then on CD. It hasn't meant much in the internet age. Once again, a day late, a dollar short, the music industry is getting together and officially changing release date to Friday. Why? Because in the United Kingdom, it was Monday was the release date. In Japan, it was Wednesday. There were other days around the world. Now there's going to be one global release date when new music is available. It's going to be Friday, except nobody's paying any attention. It's certainly not Beyonce or Drake. The people are releasing music now when they feel like it on the net. Music industry, this would have been a good move in like 1991, maybe.
Jim, big news went down February 26th when the Federal Communications Commission voted to regulate broadband internet service as a public utility. There has been this decade-long battle over what we call net neutrality. Big implications for the music industry. Tom Wheeler, the commission chairman, said this was all about preserving the internet's role as a core of free expression and democratic principles. We're talking about some of the concepts that this country was founded on, reaching into the way the music industry is going to be conducting its business going forward.
Yeah, as you said, Greg, big implications for consumers at home, big implications for the industry. To explain it all, we turn to John Brodkin, who's a senior IT reporter for Ars Technica. John, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me.
All right, John, it's striking to me, Greg and I have covered this net neutrality controversy for some time, and it's amazing to me that how many people, even well-informed people, still are hazy about exactly why it was important and about exactly what happened just recently in front of the FCC. If we put you on the spot and say, give us the three-paragraph primer.
The idea of net neutrality is that internet service providers, both your cable company or your fiber company at home, your DSL company, and also your cellular carrier, are not allowed to interfere with what you try to do online. They can't block or throttle certain websites or applications, and they can't, you know, speed up others in exchange for payment. The paid prioritization is a big part of this because people are concerned that if one company could pay for priority access to consumers, that would hurt startups who don't have the means to pay for that. And the FCC just voted to enforce these principles by reclassifying both fixed and mobile internet providers as common carriers, which is the same designation that applies to the old monopoly telephone system.
I do love that. I do, you know, because there's so much in your world of technical reporting, and so much in the universe is changing by the minute, right? But they're basically saying it's like the phone. You don't pay more and get through better via long distance on the phone if you're richer. Why should the internet be different, right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to, the whole argument that people opposing higher fees for faster speeds online, the argument they put forth.
Yeah, it even actually goes back to the railroad, because the railroad common carrier rules were then applied to the telephone system, that the owner of the railroad couldn't charge different rates to affiliated shippers than to unaffiliated shippers.
So we're looking at basically a pay-to-play type of system that this ruling supposedly avoids, you know, to put it in terms of a radio analogy. The bigger, more well-budgeted companies won't have an inside lane versus the average consumer sitting at home trying to, like, say, upload music on the internet and being able to distribute that. So the idea is to create this or maintain this level playing field. On the surface, that seems like a good idea, a democratic internet. Why has this been such a contentious issue for years and years? And in a very narrow vote, was this approved by 3-2 in the Federal Communications Commission? Why so controversial? Why did it take so long to come to this decision?
Well, there's a lot of history. I think one of the biggest events happened in 2007 when Comcast was found to be blocking BitTorrent traffic, which is a type of file sharing. And so obviously Comcast was blocking certain traffic, and then the FCC tried to intervene. And then that led to a process where they would issue rules that would prevent that from happening again. So they issued the rules in 2010, and they were sort of weak, but for some reason Verizon sued anyway to try to overturn them. And in court, Verizon said, you know, if not for these rules, we would be exploring relationships where companies could pay for priority access. Now, Verizon won that lawsuit, but then it totally backfired on them, because in order to impose the rules that the FCC wanted to impose, they had to take a more extreme step, which is to reclassify the broadband providers under this common carrier provision, the one that applies to the telephone network. And so now the ISPs have, in a sense, backtracked. They all say, we now support net neutrality. We're not going to block content. We're not going to prioritize anything, but please don't reclassify us as common carriers, because they're afraid that the FCC could use that to impose other things like rate regulation that they really don't want. But even though the FCC has said they're not going to do that, there's still controversy over it, and you know, there's a strong possibility that the cable companies will sue over this.
Give us a best and worst case scenario. Let's say there was no net neutrality. What is the best case scenario? What is the worst case scenario if these rules were not in place?
I think the worst case scenario is that cable companies, telephone companies that offer internet service, wireless providers, they could pick and choose what kinds of websites and applications that you could use online. They could say, no, you're not going to use that because we're going to block it. Or if you want to use a music service, you have to use this one because this is the one who's paying us the best deal. That's kind of the worst case scenario, I think.
We're talking to John Brodkin. He's a senior reporter covering the technical world over at Ars Technica. All right. So what does this mean, John, for music lovers? It really impacts streaming audio, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think this is, it's probably a bigger deal in the wireless world than the home internet world, because, you know, a lot of people use their smartphones to listen to Spotify, RDO, any number of music streaming services. So the idea of these rules are that your wireless provider, that's, you know, Verizon Wireless, T-Mobile, AT&T, or Sprint, they can't block a certain music service. They have to give the same access to each one, and they can't accept payment to make one work better than another. Now, we have seen some interesting things here, like T-Mobile has this thing called Music Freedom that exempts certain music services from their data caps. It makes it so you can listen to Google Music, you can listen to Spotify, Pandora, without using up your data cap, and it appears likely the FCC will allow that to continue. But, you know, there's also an argument against that, where some people will say, well, even though T-Mobile isn't charging these companies for this right to not count against the caps. They're only doing the big companies that are not allowing, you know, small radio stations that have streaming services to not count against these caps. And the other thing is that if they can just exempt a random type of service from a cap, that shows how arbitrary the caps are in the first place.
John, are we going to need more bandwidth to support unlimited usage of the internet?
I don't think so, because they're buying up a lot of spectrum in order to build out these networks, and they can charge people for data use. So if you go over a certain amount of data, you have to pay another $10 for each gigabyte. There's plenty of ways they can make money, and that is not going to stop. The wireless providers actually just pledged to spend over $40 billion in new spectrum at an auction, so
okay.
They've got plenty of money.
I suspect it as much, but it's good to hear you tell us we should not cry for big internet.
There is one interesting thing in this FCC ruling. The major wireless carriers, you know how they've mostly shifted from unlimited data plans to limited data plans. They've been doing this thing where they throttle your unlimited data plan, if you still have one, if you pass like 5 gigabytes in a month. And so that really goes against the whole idea of unlimited. There's a portion of the FCC rules that says carriers cannot renege on the promise of unlimited data.
So this is being portrayed as a victory in some circles for the music community, especially the independent musicians, smaller record companies. Would you agree with that, John, that is essentially what this represents? I mean, who are the losers in the music world, if any, because of this ruling?
I can't think of any obvious ones. The only potential loser would be if the ISPs themselves wanted to prioritize their own music services. But we haven't really seen that happen yet, so I think this is more about preventing things that could be bad rather than stopping things that are already happening.
I think the argument against it is that, you know, we're destroying the free market capabilities of the internet, the ability for these bigger companies to grow and, you know, pursue new revenue streams. Would you agree with that assessment?
Now, I think the idea is to keep the internet open so that, like the railroad or like the telephone system, anyone can innovate on top of it without having to run into a gatekeeper that says you have to either, you can't do this, or you have to pay more.
We've been talking to John Brodkin, who's been covering net neutrality for Ars Technica. John, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we want to invite you listening to share your opinions. What's your take on the net neutrality debate? Call 888-859-1800 to leave a message for the air. Coming up next on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, the Rock Doctors Clinic is open for business. Stay tuned.